steamy summer night, I'd like to investigate a koan together. One that has been so important for me in my own practice, continues to be. And this is a koan from the Gateless Gate, one of the early collections that we study in our koan curriculum, a group of koans collected by Master Wu Men. And this is an oldie but goodie. Case 41, Bodhidharma pacifies the mind. Bodhidharma faced the wall. The second ancestor stood in the snow, cut off his arm, and said, "Your disciple's mind has no peace as yet. I beg you, Master, please put it to rest." Bodhidharma said, "Bring me your mind and I will put it to rest." The second ancestor said, "I have searched for my mind, but I cannot find it." Bodhidharma said, "I have completely put it to rest for you." So, as with so many koans, it's compact, can be startling, confusing. Picture of a man standing in the snow, cutting off his arm, and then this strange dialogue. And yet, it's a koan that has lasted for centuries, that we have studied for centuries, because it points to deep and vital aspects of what's at the core of what we're doing here. So, Bodhidharma is our first Zen ancestor. He was, legend has it, the 28th in line after the Buddha. He was born and taught in India, the 28th generation of Buddhist teachers. And then he decided to make the long and dangerous pilgrimage from India to China. And he arrived in China and had an encounter with the Emperor Wu, who was a devout Buddhist emperor of one of the empires within China, and had an iconic encounter with him that startled the emperor. When he went to see the emperor, the emperor asked Bodhidharma, "I have endowed temples and authorized ordinations. What is my merit? What have I earned for doing all these things as the emperor?" And Bodhidharma says, "No merit at all." So the emperor asked, "What is the first principle of the holy teaching?" And Bodhidharma said, "Vast emptiness, nothing holy." And finally, the emperor said, "Who is this standing before me?" And Bodhidharma said, "I don't know." Well, this was not a great success for Bodhidharma. So he left the emperor's court and he went to sit for 9 years in a cave facing a wall. And that's where this koan opens. And we are told Bodhidharma faced the wall. And here was the second ancestor, a young monk named Huiko, who stood outside and legend has it, pleaded for Bodhidharma to teach him, to let Huiko be his student. And Bodhidharma ignored him. And twice he asked, and twice he was completely ignored. In some legends, Bodhidharma ridiculed him. And then finally, standing in the snow one night, Huiko was so forlorn that he cut off his arm. And Bodhidharma thought that this was evidence of Huiko's sincerity, so he took him on as a student. Now I can tell you that when people ask to be my Shokan student, I do not require the cutting off of body parts. So what is this about? Well, there is this heartfelt sincerity that the teachings say we need in order to come to Zen. If you notice, we don't go out and proselytize. We don't go out and recruit people in Newton Center to come practice in our group. This is hard practice. You have to want to do this practice. And often we say, if there's anything else that'll work for you, go do that. Because this is hard work. And usually the people who come here are coming because something is really wrong. Something is really painful. Some aspects of our lives are out of sync, out of joint. Sometimes people describe it as the dark night of the soul. For me, the out of jointness was finding myself achieving a lot in a place that really valued achievement and kept telling me this was the way to have a life and be really happy and be somebody. And I kept realizing that I was paying attention to all these things like awards and rank. And all of my colleagues were too. And that all of us were miserable. And there was just great unhappiness and worry and very little joy in this pursuit. And at the same time, what was obvious was that we were all going to pass away. And yet the pursuit was there, the sense of gotta have it, gotta go after it, because this is the only way to be okay. So that for me was the particular thing, the particular disconnect that made me say, this is not working. For some people, it's the loss of a treasured relationship. For some people, it's the falling apart of something they have taken for granted all their lives. And then there is a dark night of the soul, maybe a twilight, not so dark, but enough to bring us to the cushion, to this really hard practice. So even if we haven't cut off our arms, we're here for a reason. And Huiko says to Bodhidharma, your disciple's mind has no peace. I beg you, Master, please put it to rest. And we do come seeking that. You know, we often talk about coming initially for relaxation. And there are a lot of places that offer relaxation. Please make this mind of mine calm down. And that may work for a little while, but those of us who have known this anguish know that techniques work only for a short time. And of course, this was what was happening centuries ago. Huiko tried everything. Nothing gave him peace. And Bodhidharma does this wonderful thing in Dokusan. He says, bring me your mind. and I'll put it to rest for you. What's he doing? It is that bait and switch. It is that promise. Yeah, come on, bring it here. I'll put it to rest for you. But what he's actually doing is allowing Quico to have an experience. And the experience is that practice of looking for the mind, of asking, who am I? Looking and looking and looking and not finding it. It's a practice we still do today. It's called Huado. And if you haven't heard of this, you might want to think about it. Where we sit and we ask just what Joan Tollefson asked in the reading. Who is hearing this sound? Who is having this thought? At each moment on the cushion, that question, who am I? Who's having the experience right now? And the really transformative experience is not just on the cushion, but in our lives. Who is getting annoyed with this work colleague? Who is getting angry at being cut off in traffic? Who is feeling less than, and like I said, a stupid thing in this meeting, where I was mean to my partner? And when we ask, when we really look, the mind goes round and round. The mind looks and doesn't find. What's so different about this practice is that unlike many religious traditions where we are told what's true and we are told what to believe, Zen says we have to investigate for ourselves. We can tell each other, yeah, there's no fixed self, nothing permanent, nothing to find. But that's an idea. What Bodhidharma is inviting his student to do is really look as hard as he can. And that's the invitation for us, to really look at what's here, who is here. And so, there's no degree program in Zen. There's no boxes you can check off. There are no tests you can take. We talk about mind-to-mind transmission. And what we're really talking about is creating these containers for each other. Sitting, chanting, Dharma talks, Doksan. And with it, the invitation to have the experiences so that you know, so that we know for ourselves, as they say, whether the water is hot or cold. No one tells us. So this practice that I invite you to take on for a moment, for a sitting, or as some people do, for a lifetime, this practice of who am I? That's a practice that leads to a deep understanding in our bones of a truth that can only be conveyed through experience. And Bodhidharma, in his skill and generosity, sets up that experience, sets up an experience where Quico will be frustrated. Quico will search around. Quico will use all the strategies he can. And think about all the strategies we use to try to get things to happen on the cushion. Right? And we use them and we use them and we use them, and then they fail. And it's at that moment of failure that the light gets in, that moments of realization happen. Sometimes tiny moments, sometimes great big moments. So we assume that Quico had realization, as Bodhidharma showed him that his mind was at rest. Now, of course, we also sit here and say, wait, no mind? But how did I get here at 7:30? What do I do tomorrow at work? Do I just tell my coworkers, well, I have no mind, I'm sorry, I can't function? Right. Doesn't happen. But if you think about it, we have fictions in our lives everywhere. Money is a fiction. It's a fiction we all agree to believe in. But you can't eat it. You can't keep yourself warm with it unless you burn bills. Most of the time, it only exists as electronic data. Corporations don't exist. They are fictions that we believe in, but you can't find them. They're not a building. They're not a person. So we are used to fictions, and we're used to fictions that help us, and we're used to fictions that can really hurt us if we misuse them, if we don't see them for what they are. Money that gets pursued for its own sake because people are desperate to feel okay about themselves long after they have their material needs met. Corporations that are told they can speak as human beings in our political system. Big problems when our fictions, when our collectively held fictions are misused. And the self. Think of all the selfing that goes on when we say, me first and not you. So Zen invites us to keep looking, to keep investigating so that we see these for the fictions that they are, to be used when they are helpful, to be used to allow us to cooperate with each other as a sense of self can do in wonderful ways, but to see them also as a source of misery when we cling to this fiction and are desperate to make it real in ways that we can't possibly do. And so, as we ask this question over and over again on the cushion, we get these glimmers of realization. As our reading said, usually we set up a world in opposition to ourself and then go about trying to pocket as much wealth, power, or happiness from the world as we can. When you accord with Buddha Dharma, your true self is the entire world. And in this world, there is no possibility of exchange. No me, no you. Just one big oneness. The life of the true self is not apart from our functioning. Everything we encounter is our life. And that's how we put the self to rest.
So, sit comfortably.
Thoughts, questions?
Kevin.
Thanks for the talk. Quite interesting. I don't know how I would answer the question, or how I would say, bring you my mind. But sometimes it feels like when doing this Wado practice, and I say, you know, who is this? I'm me. Oh, okay. And then it's sort of answered. And so I find the practice a bit challenging. But I think I came to this practice not for the reasons you described, where I had some problem. It was more that I was intellectually convinced of no self, and I didn't feel it. thought I want to understand myself, and so need some way into that. And so, but I don't. So I think that's why I've stuck with this, even though, you know, I've only caught glimpses of this idea. So I was wondering if you could sort of talk mm-hmm. about it. Sometimes when you go looking mm-hmm. for the self, you do find it. You have that experience of self.
Yeah.
And so it seems like, oh, I'm me. The question answered. And
right.
So
and
then,
that's most of our experience, right? And most of the world stops there. And you're saying that's all you need, right?
Well, not necessarily. Just if I wasn't sort of a priori convinced, it wouldn't. It is not the case that when I go looking, I don't find it. I feel like I do find it.
Uh-huh.
But I somehow know that what I'm finding isn't real. But I sort of knew that not because of the practice, but I was intellectually convinced of that
yeah,
first.
Yeah.
So.
So it's an intellectual way in, which is a perfectly legitimate and common way in to this practice. But what holds you here?
I am a very curious person. I want to know things about the world, and especially the internal world. I can't think of a different way to do it.
So there's something you gotta solve.
So if I could add something, you know, Zazen is a technology for exploring this, you know, what you said that you were rightly intellectually convinced of. And when we do Zazen, we directly experience the fact that there's no one in control. You know, there's no sovereign self to be sure, you know, for certain, that we sometimes can't even reliably count our breaths to 10, you know, and that the boundaries between what you were calling me and everything else, we start to see just how porous and movable and uncertain those are. So I guess I would recommend, you know, Zazen as the technique that was invented to help move from the intellectual understanding, which is where I started, to a more visceral understanding that again is closer to, you know, knowing if the water is warm or cold by drinking it or putting your hand in it.
Will,
I guess I could just jump on that because I resonate now with what you're saying, Kevin, in a certain way. I mean, I do feel like I've come into and gone out of the experience of not being able to find the self, but that has always felt really special to me, like a big deal. And I know, you know, just the intellectual part, I guess, that this sort of who am I question, you know, resonates through religious mysticism around the world through all the centuries of existence, right? And but then that sort of makes me think, well, you know, I can't just like ask myself the question and like see that, you know, that would be really simple, and who am I to, you know. So I have this sort of like an everyday answer that I don't know if it's sort of what you're talking about, Kevin, but it's sort of like, oh, well, there's something there. I'm not looking at it hard enough, but man, really hard, and I don't know if I can really see there, you know, sort of lose confidence in yourself.
Yeah.
And as you said, Alan, then I guess I do feel like that whole process doesn't do me any good.
Mm.
And so the question, if it's caught in sort of mind going around saying, what's self? Is this? No, it can't really be that. They're still just thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And the sort of, you know, I mean, it's almost like a like working out or something. It's a physical process of, you know, feeling the pain in your legs and thinking, wait, I'm not moving. What's going on? And, you know, and sometimes it sort of sneaks up on you. you know. So there is a kind of visceral learning, but I feel like my intentions are too much about like having some kind of experience. And of course, if you're setting out to have an experience, it's never gonna, you're just gonna keep doing that.
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah, that's so important, you know, that I'm gonna have this no self experience
right.
now. I'm gonna go get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know? And I think what Alan was pointing to is that Zazen really leaves us open to these accidental seeing beyond,
yeah.
seeing outside.
Yeah. Right.
You know, body, one phrase is body and mind dropping away, but often it's less dramatic and it's just a kind of loosening
yeah.
of a sense of self.
Right.
But can't legislate it, can't make
right.
it happen.
Right.
Wiko was trying so hard to make
right.
it happen and he finally managed it.
Often when I think about Bodhidharma, you know, I have the image of him in the cave for 9 years, and sometimes, and you know, you brought up that a lot of our social conventions are sort of fictions, and but you know, a lot of us can't just like go into a cave, but then I thought about how, well, you know, we have our kind of floating cave here in this room. But you know, I just thought if I were to just, you know, like throw away my mind, you know, and sit in front of a wall, you know, for the rest of my existence, you know, like people would be concerned. Like not that I'm actually going to do that, but I just feel like, you know, there's limitations to, you know, it's not silly.
but it's not a viable life plan in.
Yeah.
You know, Newton in 2018.
Yeah.
Right? But
that doesn't mean that we can't see beyond these fictions.
Right.
Well, and the wall, it doesn't need to be an actual wall, right? We watch what happens is that our minds meet us. We get met in practice where we need to be met. And so whatever needs to come up, comes up. You know, so for you, Kevin, it is this doubt. And this intellectual quandary that you're, you know, for me it was something else. But it's always, and sometimes like I'll be sitting on sesshin, and it'll be, oh no, not this. You know, like, no, this wasn't what I was gonna have to think about. And it's often just exactly where I need to be met in terms of the qualities of my mind, of my ruminations. And then there are these moments where it just drops away. But that can't be engineered. We can only set ourselves up in Zazen for these kinds of things to happen, and we have no way of knowing what they're going to be or what's going to appear on that wall that we're sitting in front of.
My wife thinks Zen is whacked. You know?
Okay.
She belongs to a different Buddhist. And I never try to miss an opportunity to, you know, reinforce a position. I came across this very same story this morning. I said, you got to hear this one, right? She said, what's it like? I said, well, it's like the Christian story of the crucifixion, in that if you believe that Christ is God and the Holy Spirit are all one, Christ is getting crucified in the story, and he's saying, oh God, why have you forsaken me? So who's he talking to? Where's the self, even in this God?
Mm-hmm.
And so I read her the story, and she just sort of rolled her eyes and said, cut his arm off, eh? You know, where's self-harm? Don't think of it being symbolic. It's renunciation. And it's kind of like what you were talking about, how all this stuff that we think is important, going from money to status, we do, to some extent, you know, experience renunciation with that. I've been finding that with myself emotionally. Now, if I'm not getting angry, what is this I'm feeling? This is what I've been dealing with lately. You know, it's not anger. It's being perplexed, baffled. It's not an uncomfortable feeling. but it's not one I'm truly familiar with either. You know? So anyway, that's
that, that anger's the more familiar
right.
place for you.
Yeah.
And then when that when you
the stimulus happens and it doesn't occur.
And it doesn't occur, then what's there? And
yeah.
that's that looking deeper and looking again and looking again. That the practice is exactly what the practice is about. It's that constant looking again and looking again. And it is whacked. It's practice. Yeah?
That actually really resonated with me quite a bit, because I feel like when I have those moments where I'm like, well, who is thinking, sometimes it gets, like, I get an answer kind of like Kevin's, where it's like, duh, you. But...
Can people hear back there? Can you guys hear?
Well, sometimes when I ask myself, well, who's sitting, who's thinking, who am I, essentially, I get an answer kind of like what Kevin mentioned, where it's just, oh, it's me. But other times, I'm surprised when I'm not here, when I'm not sitting on the cushion, and I'm not actively trying to solve the puzzle. And that's when, to me, it seems like I get this sort of the sense that kind of the renunciation piece, but more from the perspective of trying to get rid of the attachment to the self a bit, because I might surprise myself with a mean thought or a kindness, or I have a feeling that would typically make me sad about myself, but to have a moment where you say, well, who is that? And you can have that moment of compassion, and things can fall away a little bit, and you can lose your identity just enough
right, right.
where it seems like then when you come back to the cushion, even though you have this kind of ping-ponging around mentality, you can kind of remind yourself a little bit more saliently or with a little more conviction
yeah.
that you are connected to all of these other things, and even if you're not feeling it right now, that's kind of like a weird sort of faith. And that's where, to me, it gets a little interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think you're pointing to something, too, that's important, which is that, like, we're not having these experiences all the time. Like, they're fleeting. And
mm-hmm.
they come and they go, they pass. But that you can touch back to them. You can say, oh, you know, we have a memory of, yeah, I saw beyond this little self that I was all obsessed with. There are these moments when I see a bigger picture. And that it's having the memory of those that can sometimes help us keep going.
The self is temporary
yeah.
sort of thing.
Yeah.
Who I was when I said, well, who am I? And I'm like, oh, well, I'm done, me. That's very different sometimes than the me I am, like, 5 minutes from now.
Right.
Or
yeah.
a breath from now.
Oh.
So it just came up for me as I was thinking about the really broad range of the sentence, who am I, or who are you? That I think a lot of times when we talk about it in this context, it's a very dreamy kind of, who am I?
Yeah, yeah.
But I think that kind of leads... I try and turn myself away from that kind of direction, because I don't suppose that there's anything at the end of that path. Like, I don't think that that's really a path.
Right.
I think that's
right.
staring straight up
right.
into the sky.
Yeah.
Because sometimes someone might, you know, it could be a very different meaning behind them. Yeah. Who are you? Who do you think you are?
Yeah.
You know, and that's
yeah.
the same, you know, the same concepts, but that has a sort of like immediate epiphany that you realize, like, oh, what was I?
Right. Right.
Why did I do that? You know, why did I think that that was okay?
Right, right. It's not in the calm, placid moments that this question has its punch. It's when you're furious about something, or you're just devastated, or, you know, those are the moments where that question has an aliveness. When someone has just trashed something you've been working on for weeks.
I
I also wanted to suggest that, you know, there's nothing magic about the specific phrasing.
Right.
And if who am I doesn't work, and it doesn't work particularly for me, then something like what is this might work better, or what's this thinking, or when I'm in pain, for example, you know, at a sashim, who's the one that feels this pain? Not who am I, but who's the one feeling? And who's the one who doesn't feel pain? Because there's also somebody that doesn't. So I would encourage you to, if that phrasing pulls you in the wrong direction, just to drop it and try some of these other ones.
Yeah,
Kevin. I just want
to say that on that point, I've noticed one thing that works really well for me is like, who am I talking to? Because I'm kind of this constant monologue, seeming dialogue going through. I'm like saying things, or I've got words in there, and it's like, who am I talking to? And like, that for me has been a different sort of window into the scene.
Yeah, really important, right, that this phrase, who am I, isn't the, you know, that there are other phrases that may have much more liveliness for you at a particular moment in practice.
Tim, when you said that, I couldn't help thinking of that famous moment in The Taxi Driver where Travis is saying, you talking to me? You must be talking to somebody.
Yeah.
Maybe we should.
Catherine, were you
Yeah, I was just going to say, this brings up for me this thing that I feel when I'm here, which is in contrast to a different decade in my life when I was very immersed in relational cultural theory, so that everything about who I am was really who I am to other people. Like, everything is a story. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my relationship with you is your expectations of me, your experience of me, and, you know, vice versa. And other than that, I don't really exist. So when I'm alone meditating, none of that falls away, and then I realize that the story is mine, and my striving is mine, and my what I'm trying to acquire is my story. And when I come here, the beauty of it is, I don't really know any of you. I have no idea what your story is, and you don't know me or have an expectation of you. If I saw you in the grocery store, I'd say, "Oh, I know you from Hank," or something. You know, I would recognize you, but it sort of ends there. We talk a little bit lightly in conversation about going on vacation, or who's having, you know, just particularly hard month at work or something like that, but there isn't this kind of relational expectation that we have, no story.
Yeah.
So it's really easy to be here doing this work together, not in a family system or a work system, where you just really can't drop that stuff very easily, or it's much harder to do it. Like, I find it much harder, but it does help me then have an awareness of those situations of, this expectation that I think this person has of me is my story about what this person's expectation is, and it makes it easier to sort of stop and think, now what I'm striving for, I'm doing to myself. This person isn't doing it to me.
Right.
But, you know,
and
so
you
this practice is good, the not having, thank you very much, any expectations of me, but but that's sort of two different ways of
thinking. Well, we should probably
let's do our vows,
but we can talk more after.
The closing chant is on the last page of the Sutra book, page 90.